Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show with hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamai. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil. How have you been?
I've been okay, a little under the weather with a cold I'm just getting over.
Yes, I think I can hear a little of that in your voice still.
To my fellow broadcasters, don't worry. I'm not breathing out at the microphone, just in as I talk.
Good to know.
How was your weekend?
Well, it was great, Phil. I joined the orienteering group, the EWOC, Eastern Washington Orienteering Club, and did the Sandpoint Scramble. That's mainly on bikes. You drive and bike. Well, you don't drive. You bike or walk all over Sandpoint looking for the targets that they've hidden away.
And so it has nothing to do with eggs. It's all about finding hidden treasures.
It's like an Easter egg hunt, except you don't get any Easter eggs. It was really fun, though. I'd recommend it for anyone who'd like to try orienteering. Had a good time.
Yeah, we got out and did a couple short little hikes with friends coming from out of town, and it was a typical spring day Sunday. It started off sunny, then it was a little grapple, then it was sunny again, and then it rained a little, and then it was foggy, and then it snowed, and then it turned to sun again.
And it sounds like we're headed for more of that. What is the weather looking like?
Well, looking outside today, it's not bad. We've got a little bit of that sun in the sky. Increasing clouds, though, throughout the day with a high of 52 degrees. Then tonight, it turns into a chance of sprinkles. That's kind of a new one. Not showers, not rain. A chance of sprinkles with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow, there's a chance of rain, 30%. A high of 54. Tomorrow night, a low of 38 with a chance of showers. So we go from sprinkles to rain to showers. Then Thursday, it's looking like it's going to be wet. Showers likely. Thursday night, showers likely. Friday, it just says showers, showers, showers on the way through the weekend. So it looks like we've got a bit of rain coming up in our future.
Sure does. I guess that will keep us from worrying about fires, which is our topic today.
Yeah, we've got a lot of fun stuff today. Well, fun in the sense of at least preventing fires, I suppose, and learning things that we can do to do that. So why don't you go ahead and introduce the guest?
Yes, I will. Well, we're joined this morning by Mark Sauter. He's a fire marshal with the local fire department. That would be Sagal, Sandpoint, and a new one, Westside, right, Mark?
Yes, that's right. Thanks for having me, Julie.
Yeah, good morning. So happy to have you here today. And, well, let's begin. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your position? You're a fire marshal, but I don't think you're a typical fire marshal.
I've worked doing this for a couple of years now. I retired from the fire service after 30-some years in California. Came up, started to volunteer with the local fire department, and after being around for about a year, recognized that it looked like we could do some work in fire prevention. Always better to prevent the fire than to have to emergency respond to it. So I presented that to the chief and said, what do you think about me going out and meeting with residents and talking to him about fire prevention? He supported that. I did it on a volunteer basis for a couple of months. And at some point he said, you know what, this is valuable. We need to do this a little more regularly. So I did it then I became a part-time worker. I work one day a week, seven hours.
Okay. It became a position. Yeah. That's great.
So
a one day
seven
per week.
Hours of work a week. Yes.
So that's how the marshals differed in the structure than the commander or chief.
Yeah, the chief has the responsibilities, emergency, administrative, and then all the staffing responsibilities for the department, budgeting. For me, I work on fire prevention and public education. Those two go hand in hand. So that's my main focus, is to work and talk to residents and any property owners. And then most recently, last fall, I started working on a commercial inspection program in Sagal. Previously they had about 34 inspections that they did every year to different businesses. And reality is there were more businesses than that. So we reached out and informed all the business owners that we'd start inspecting their businesses. And we've had great success with it. We're now probably our actual number is over 100, and we're getting close to that as far as catching up and doing all those inspections. And annually we would do that. And now, so it's kind of organizing it, getting it started, and then getting it to where it's just something that we do every year.
So do you do the inspections, or do you give them information ahead of time to be in compliance at the time of the inspection?
Thanks for asking. It's the engine company that works in Sagal that will do those inspections. Just like in Sandpoint, it's the engine companies that go out and meet the business owners, familiarize themselves with the business, it's a compliance check. But before all that starts, we put together a packet for the business owners, so there's no surprises. We send it out to them, say we'll schedule an inspection, and then they have a check sheet that we use So they know right away, well, fire extinguishers are going to be important because they're going to look for that exiting, all the things that are just make a building safe. Everybody wants to, that goes into a business that visits it and buys from it, wants to be able to go out and go home. So that's what we're trying to make sure we have that happens.
So it's kind of a new, something that's growing within the fire department due to your educational efforts and should create greater safety for the community.
Well, hopefully we'll improve and we'll make those business inspections. And, 50% of the businesses that have a fire don't reopen. So clearly we want to prevent the fire. And even if we do have to respond to a fire there, if we are familiar with the business and they've had some fire safe activities there, the fire should be minimized. So our hope is that obviously we keep all of our businesses operating and everybody safe going in and out.
So where did you learn how to do that? All the information you bring to bear, where did you get that training?
Mostly from the fire service where I used to work, and lots of reading and then just trying to think through, okay, how can we make all this work in our area? And what's fair to the business owners and what's fair to the firefighters, and trying to seek a good balance of an education. So,
Mark, is that the only area that you do mandatory inspections? You don't do residential mandatory inspections?
We don't do mandatory inspections. Our departments are primarily I'm funded by the Sagal Fire District. So most of my work is in Sagal. However, it's hard for me to look at something and say, hey, wait a minute, why are we not, dealing with this in Sandpoint as well? So I'll talk to the chief about it. But I don't have any responsibilities technically in Sandpoint unless I'm asked to work on something. Mandatory
the homeowners
stuff.
Yeah.
We're notified from the county planning department for any building location permits. And that's the county building process, if you will. So whenever we get notified, then we know, okay, somebody's going to build a structure, remodel something. Generally, it's a new house. So then we'll make a contact sometime over the course of that construction and talk to the homeowners. And then we also do the same property visit for people that want to call and ask and schedule something.
And I've actually experienced that. I've had a tour of the or a prevention visit from
right.
Mark.
And we're happy to do that. In fact, we'll do it this year. Our number, you can call us, schedule a meeting for us. You can call 208-263-3502. And our office staff will take your name and address down and we'll get some contacts and we'll make a property visit.
So you're doing commercial and residential and one day a week. Are you covering only the Sagal part or is someone else covering Sandpoint and West Side?
The engine company, that's a good question. Thank you. We have a fire engine crew in Sandpoint, and they're responsible for the commercial inspections here. So I don't have to do that. Westside has their own program that's beginning to work to become a little more organized. And then, so Sagal is really the one that I have my main focus on. This time of year, for several months a year, not too many building location permits are issued. Most people don't start their construction project from October until March. So I can catch up on things. And then once spring hits, especially come May or June, that's when I can get 20 building location permits in a week. So it's quite a few. Last year we did 145 building location permits just in Sagal.
And so we've been the implication is, at least, we're looking at structural things inside, but also where we live, there's an element of the outside risk or danger, wildfire coming onto a property. And do you look for those mitigations?
Absolutely. We have a form that we're happy to send out to anybody if they want, kind of a check sheet so they can evaluate their own property. But that's your great point. In the wildland, the goal with defensible space and construction features is really to have, as crazy as it may sound, a wildland fire burn around a structure to where, bless you, the fire actually wouldn't necessarily extend into a home. It would burn around it safely and then keep on going because it's real hard to stop a fire and just with a roadblock. So that's the goal, is to have that defensible space and have the construction features and watching the storage. And our form that that we're happy to send out or give out. It. We're going to be at the county fairgrounds this weekend for a builder show, both Saturday and Sunday. We're happy to share that with people to make sure. But yes, the natural conditions around a building are very important.
So people who are new to the area or considering moving here, what are some of the top things for them to look for as they're building or purchasing a home in terms of making it fire safe?
The top sections would be the features of the terrain. You know, is it on flatland like we are here in Sandpoint, mid-slope, at the top of a ridge, and that has all to do with wind. Where does the structure face? Does it face the sun? Is it on a west or southwest facing slope? Those are usually drier areas, so they're, you know, ideally or not ideally. If they do burn, it's a faster, drier burn than say on the north side of a hill. We all know where those are, those wet areas where there's still some snow. Construction features, how they build their house. Do they build it with a composition or a metal roof? They have the cement siding. Do they have all the vents closed up with eighth inch, you know, metal screening, so embers don't extend into the house or into the attic and then start a fire? You know, we only have limited resources up here. If we do get a wildland fire, we want to make sure that those fires can burn around a structure, that we don't need a fire engine at every house. Another one is access. What's the access to this neighborhood? Is it on a county road? Are there two ways in and out? We have some areas in Sagal that are just a one road, into a draw or a drainage, as we may call it, that's on a hill that faces south or west. Those areas, if there's a fire that starts at the bottom of the hill, they're real challenging to evacuate the neighborhood, as well as for us to get in there and for us to get in there and fight a fire. So you can see it's nice to be able to move around and exiting. You know, it's all buildings and even houses, you want to be able to have two ways out. So, so defensible space is the other part. Do the trees come right over the roof and, you know, drop needles in the gutters and create a flammable environment all the time? Or are those areas thinned out and the gutters cleaned and vegetation not up against the house or up against windows that would burn? So there's a lot you can do to really reduce the fire hazards at your home.
And even wood piles next to the home. I got a little lesson in that when you came out. You think it's nice to have your wood right next to your door you're going to be coming and going from, but that's kind of a no-no, right?
It is. You think about it, how does a fire get to my house from the wildland? And it starts with embers usually. It's like a blizzard of these fire embers that get blown into your house or your wood pile. So it's just a bunch of sparks first. And when you have a big stack of wood, you turn the side of your house into a big bonfire. So what you want is your wood pile to be away from your house. It's understood you're going to have some of your firewood for a weekly or a daily use, but you don't want to have 3/4 of wood stacked up against the side of the house.
That would be a big bonfire.
Right.
So what are some of the inside things?
Inside residential stuff, we usually don't actually go. We make a lot of suggestions. The inside stuff would be smoke detectors, having some fire extinguishers, making sure that everybody knows how to get out of the house, not too much clutter, having your house, you know, built by reputable people. There's lots of, the state does electrical inspections on new homes. So making sure that all of those things are done correctly and then not altered. So, and that can create a pretty fire safe home. No openings into the walls or ceilings or attics.
Let's go back to the outside for a minute. Should those of us who live a little ways from town expect y'all to show up with a fire truck full of water and just spray everything down? Does it work that way?
Well, thanks for asking that. Usually we work on having a water or bringing our own water with us, but realistically that's only 800 gallons at a time. So there's lots of areas, and we always encourage people to consider having some kind of a fire cistern. If they don't live in an area that has fire hydrants or have some obvious water supply nearby. And we have some areas that have been developed that's part of their development agreement, is that they'll have water that's staged for us.
Oh, in the neighborhood.
So in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So we always, that's on our form as well. Where's the local water? In some cases, it's a mile or two away. In some cases, it's just next door. But we always look for that. It's hard to, if you have a structure fire, it's really hard to bring enough water with you. You've got to ultimately set up a shuttle. And that's usually a few different fire engines moving water around. So you can already can think, hey, that's a lot of people. And that's just bringing the water. That's not actually doing the firefighting. So it's much easier and much faster and safer for us to have a water source near the home. And your insurance companies will often ask that, where's the nearest fire station and where's the nearest water source? Mm-hmm. So some insurance companies now are beginning to ask, is, you know, if you have a cistern, you can get some credit for it.
So I've never seen a helicopter sitting outside the fire department in Sagal nor in Sandpoint. Does that come into play with our local fire departments or is that a different situation?
We have agreements with IDL and the Forest Service, and occasionally we will get fire helicopter work. Mostly we do, you know, for Sandpoint, we do structure fighting. It's the wildland, and that's where we get IDL and Forest mm-hmm. Service help, and that's when we get the aircraft.
Okay. Well, for those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. If you're not able to listen to our entire show this morning, you can catch it later on a podcast. I'll have that up later today. And if you're getting out of our area, you can live stream us at krfy.org. Well, I'm looking at this checklist, Mark, and I'm seeing a number of things that I'm going to have to go home and work on. I'm not very excited about that, although I do have a few that look like I'm covered on. I think those of you who come to the county fairgrounds are going to want a copy of that. Well, let's see. Would you like to tell us about that event coming up this weekend? You touched on it, but you didn't say too much about it.
I would, but there's two things that I didn't mention.
Oh,
just a minute.
It.
I was getting a little long-winded. One thing that I know, Julie, I talked to you when I was out at your place, addressing and access. Very important that we have a lot of roads out here, a lot of dirt roads and a lot of paved ones with lots of driveways that enter the roadway. But no address signs.
And long driveways sometimes.
Long driveways. Driveways that even split, that you can't tell which side, you know, which way should I go, right or left here at this fork. So we encourage everyone to get an illuminated, you know, whether it's just a reflective sign, but certainly not painting brown on a rock with a number that gets covered with snow or you can't see at night to direct us in.
Maybe a nice solar address sign that would light up.
And we have local vendors here that make the green and white signs. We've all seen them.
Yeah, reflective, but they are high up.
Sure. And to have, you could have, and street signs as well. The county will actually supply street signs for us.
But they need to be high enough. We forget about the snow.
Right. And in fact, this last winter, there were a lot of signs when I'm driving around or walking around that I see, hey, wait a minute, I know that address is usually there. But at 3 to 4 feet of snow, and all of a sudden, you can't see it. So making sure that we can see an address and that we have access to the road on a road that you can drive a fire engine on, meaning it's not super steep.
Grown over with trees.
Grown over, or that it's cleared in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of us drive on some pretty icy, slippery roads. When you're in a fire engine, it's not so comfortable and not so easy to do that. And finally, the other piece that I hadn't spoken about is fire ignition sources near your structure. You talked about the wood pile, but lots of times there's homes that are built pretty close together. Anything that's built within that 50 to 100 foot radius, you want to make sure you're watching that building just the same as you're watching your own, whether it's a garage, whether it's a woodshed or your neighbor's house. So it's all fuel load. And once one structure is ignited, it's real tough to break and make sure that next structure doesn't get ignited.
So are there steps that individuals can do if a fire suddenly breaks out, a fire extinguisher, any specific advice you can give to the immediate response after calling 911?
Yeah. Having a supply of fire extinguishers inside and outside in the other buildings is important. Lots of people have the little, what they call their own fire hydrants, which is a good all weather water source that they have that comes off their well or their pump system that they can use with a hose attached with a nozzle. and a hose that'll go all the way around their building. So they can do their own, you know, preliminary firefighting work. And often that's all they need. You know, it's a little burn pile that goes awry. And now the next thing is that, oh, wait a minute, now it's burned up against my house. So in Sandpoint, our response time is about 5 minutes. But in Sagal, depending on where you are and how far you are off the highway, it could be a 10-minute response time, which is fast in real terms. But when you're waiting, if you have a fire and you've called 911, 10 minutes is a long time to wait.
Oh, yeah.
So having something to do and a plan in your own head on what I can do to try and mitigate this problem and until the firefighters get here is important.
And if they can't find your address, it might be 15 minutes.
It can be. If in a fire situation, oftentimes we'll see the smoke if it's daytime. But if it's nighttime, it's hard to see it. And, you know, we go on a lot of first aid calls in all the areas. So it's not just finding someplace in the daytime. It's finding them at night in inclement weather. So those are issues.
Yeah.
You asked about the home show.
Yes.
And thanks for asking me about it. We have a booth. We do fire prevention and fire and public education at our booth. It'll be Saturday and Sunday at the county fairgrounds. And we did that last year. We had a lot of people that came by. We have brochures. We have things for the children. And this year we'll have what's called the Ember House. And it'll be a prop for kids to play with and kind of see where the fire embers could go at a house that was unprotected.
So interactive for kids.
Right, interactive for kids.
And so what are the times of the show?
You know, I wish I had that.
That's okay.
I'll say about 9 to 5 on
I'm sure
Saturday
we can go.
And
readers can, listeners can go to one of the online sources.
Yeah, and I think it's 10 to 4 on Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Saturday and Sunday. Anyway, you mentioned something that I'd like us to follow up on, and that is burn piles. We're getting into that season now where snow's melted, people are gathering in their yard debris. And tell us about do's and don'ts, dates, what needs to happen if people are doing a burn pile.
The IDL has a website, and you can get issued your own burn permit. I think from now until early May, it's an open burning period, and that's usually posted on the Sagal Fire Station. They have a billboard out there, and it'll say that.
Yeah.
It's open burning at least until early May right now, unless something changes. We dry out really bad, really severely, or winds come up, we may change that. But generally, it's until early May. The typical prevention stuff is have an area that's cleared away from, you know, your burn piles away from your house or any structures. You have an area that's cleared around the burn pile. So in other words, when the pile starts, the grasses that are 3 feet high don't also catch. Have some tools around, shovels, McCluskeys, whatever you may have to beat the fire back and keep it from burning into any kind of grass or weeds. Have some kind of a water supply would be great. You know, if it's one of those little, you know, frost-free hydrants that people have with enough hose to go all the way around the pile, you're on your way. Start in the morning to where the fire can get. You don't want to usually start it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the winds start picking up. And usually those fires go okay.
Yeah, and Wednesday morning with a 70% chance of rain would probably be a great time.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, get those things started.
And is there any guideline on how large of a brush pile you should be working with, or not really?
I think IDL actually has some information on their the size of the piles and all that. So
because they can sure flame up pretty high.
They can. The larger machine piled ones can get very big. Right.
We do have a seasonality here, and of course, then as you mentioned, early May. After that, you permits required, but even then, at a certain point, we go into a burn ban typically each summer.
Right. And that may happen in July or August. A couple of years ago, we had a burn ban that lasted for, I'd say, a couple of months till it started raining. Last year wasn't so much. So often we get summer rains that'll go through here and keep things fairly green. So we'll just have to wait to see what the weather's like this year.
I'd like to back up again and talk a little bit more about the fire department. Just how big is it? There's a lot going on with the local fire departments because they've joined together and doing a lot more work together. Let's talk for a moment about that.
Okay. I think it was 2 years ago now, Sagal and Sandpoint established a joint powers agreement. So the two departments can operate as one. They have a single fire chief and administrative assistant. that do the administrative work for the two departments. So they've saved money that way. They've organized themselves to where they work a lot closer together, and the staffing from each of the previous departments now work as one. So we'll have Sagal staff that'll work in Sandpoint and vice versa. So it makes it nice, since they both go to the same fires. Now they can all train together. So there's some sense in training together and working closer together. And there's always a savings there as far as
mm-hmm. yeah. money goes. And then, so did the procedures of all the departments become uniform? Do you all work sort of in the same way now, or?
Right. Thanks for asking. Yes. I think just most recently they've established their own rules and regs for both the departments that are the same. And it took a while to get the two groups to make sure, you know, everybody does firefighting the same way. Everybody does their EMS delivery the same way. They all have the same supplies. So even though they keep all the bills separate, but now they're buying the same equipment, and it's just a lot easier instead of having different equipment on in different areas.
And so now Westside is brought into the mix as well?
Yes. In the fall, last fall, Westside started, joined the district, as we would call it, Selkirk Fire District. And Westside has done the same thing. So their volunteers work with the volunteers for the other departments. And their fire chief became the assistant chief for for Selkirk. So he does administrative work for the entire district now as well.
So we'd be putting you on the spot to talk about Northside if eventually that's going to wrap in.
You know, I can't even. Yeah,
we won't go there.
Yeah, I don't have any information on that at all. It's just, I know it's also nice. It's just kind of a comfortable way to go that, you know, first it was Sagal and then Westside joined in, and they seem to be happy with Westside area. And by the way, Westside, if you don't know, is Dover and then west from there. Goes into Renco Loop area and then down the road.
Makes sense. Mark, has it changed the way that you respond to fires? Is that any different?
They get more resources now, and it's easier to get more resources. They have the resources out of Sandpoint can respond immediately for all of Sagal, and then for Westside, their volunteers have more access to equipment, and again, more volunteers from Sandpoint can come that way as well.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. Usually we do a musical break, but we dug into the archives and we actually found, I think, one of the original KRFY volunteers, Robert Frost, reading in his own words his poem Fire and Ice, which is fairly short, but it's a real treat. And then we're going to follow it up with a little fire interlude from Billy Joel. Billy Joel, We Didn't Start the Fire.
We definitely didn't start the fire.
But if Billy didn't, somebody did. And there are fire inspectors who specialize in that aspect of finding out what happened.
There are. And actually, for those types of calls, for fire investigation, and it could be an arson investigation, we typically call the state fire marshal. They come in, there's an office in Coeur d'Alene, and they have more offices in Moscow. And oftentimes we'll remain on an incident scene for security, and then we'll call the state fire marshal in to come in and make an investigation.
But your inspections are beforehand to hopefully prevent the fire.
Right. That's what most of our work, or my work, is prevention, and that's what we'll do.
So you've mentioned a couple of times emergency response, EMS services, and in the county there's the fire districts, mm-hmm. but there's also a county dedicated EMS. How do you guys work together?
Actually, they work well together. What happens is the county has an EMS system. That's a choice here that our county commissioners made years and years ago to stand that up. I think they had problems with a private entity that did emergency medical service and transport. So the county stood their own up, and they've operated it for quite some time. The county fire departments, whether it's paid or volunteer, if you think about it geographically, we have a big area to cover. There's only a few EMS stations, and there's more fire districts and fire stations. Some of those are paid. So for EMS calls, like in Sagal or Sandpoint, we always respond in a fire engine out to those calls. Oftentimes we're there before the EMS people get there. And that's important because then they can start emergency medical care for somebody, whether it's put them on oxygen, start to evaluate the patient, start to think about what kind of transport they need. Oftentimes, somebody will need to be helicoptered. They can look at it, it's a trauma patient, it's on the highway. They can get that helicopter started and say, hey, you know what, we're going to have to start working on this. Or they can communicate with EMS as they drive in and know that. Yes, ma'am.
Mark, you're firefighters, obviously, but do you have some first aid training? You're not EMSs, but can you do anything when you get there?
Absolutely. Everybody's an EM, you know, all the emergency responders are EMTs.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. So and some of them have even advanced training after that. So good. They have lots of EMT and they have all their EMS supplies. So they can do quite a bit before the paramedics or before the Bonner County EMS people get there.
I know living on the south side of the Long Bridge, it's nice to know there's something on that side of the river.
Right. It's nice to know that there's a station down there for fire and for EMS. But the other thing that we often don't think about is what happens to that during that period of time when they're already busy on something else. So how do we do that? We backfill with volunteers with the Sandpoint and Sagal fire departments. They'll backfill the station, start, you know, get an engine to be ready to go. But that's challenging at times. If there's a major incident that's down the highway, it'll pull resources from Sandpoint. And the same goes if Sandpoint's real busy, it'll pull resources from south of Long Bridge. So
let's talk about volunteers a little bit too. The department relies on volunteers. Tell us a little bit about recruitment and training and retention of volunteers.
We have 30 plus volunteers right now. We always are trying to get more volunteers because life gets in the way. Some people move away. We just hired two of our volunteers as paid staff. So if you think about it, that's usually a nice way to go for the volunteers to work for a while and then we can hire them. The department capitalizes on getting training already, but we're always looking for more and then trying to retain them. We expect them and ask them to respond at all hours to emergency calls. And usually it's just to go to the fire station to staff another fire engine. So it's not always for firefighting. Oftentimes it's to come in and back everybody up. So retention's a factor. And then we always try and train them at least a couple times a month. They have training.
Mm-hmm. And so. What is the training process like for a volunteer? How long does that take? Do they pay for it?
It's free. They will have a Firefighter One Academy. Usually it's once or twice a year for the area. Oftentimes you'll get North Side, you'll get, you know, some West Side people, some Sagal, and occasionally we'll even have resources from, you know, Priest River or Priest Lake that'll all be involved in this academy. Then once they get through that academy, then they can start to be volunteering. Respond and call.
So if someone's listening and they decide this is for me, or at least I want to check this out, how do they find out more?
I'd suggest they call the Selkirk office, again, 263-3502, and ask them if they, you know, to take their name down and have someone from the fire department call them back and schedule an appointment so they can be considered as a volunteer.
And Mark, for those folks out there that are considering this, is there a substantial physical requirement to be a firefighter, even a volunteer?
Well, to be a firefighter, we're going to consider them as a firefighter, just like we do the paid staff. So they're expected to be able to take care of themselves and others. It's not just about taking care of yourself. So occasionally we'll have someone that wants to volunteer for the department, but may not have the physical abilities to do the most strenuous work. So there's always things to do that we're happy to have volunteers help with. For instance, this weekend at the public education and fire prevention booth that we have, it doesn't take any special physical prowess.
So you shouldn't be afraid to call in if you want to help out.
We love to have volunteers. So if anybody wants to volunteer and help out, it's a worthy cause. You're certainly helping your fellow residents, and we're happy to have them and help them organize it.
You mentioned you had about 30 volunteer firefighters. How many paid? How many staff firefighters are there?
There's 21 within the three departments, three areas now: West Side, Sandpoint, and Sagal. all making up Selkirk.
The Selkirk. So we have a few minutes left. For young listeners out there who maybe are contemplating fireman, astronaut, policeman, what influenced you growing up?
You know what? I did not have firefighter on my windshield when I was growing up. I wanted to be a forester. I went to a year of forestry school at Humboldt State in California. That was my first taste of things. And after a year of it, I looked around. There were no jobs back then. That was in the 70s. And it didn't pay, and even if I was lucky enough to get a job, didn't pay very well. My brother was a firefighter. And from being around him for a couple of years, I went, I could probably do something like that. And on my days off, I could be a forester. So, I could try that. So it's funny, 30 plus years later, I've finished my career in the fire service. I have some property now, and I go through all the University of Idaho forestry classes. So I'm trying to be a forester again. You
can practice your hobby here with some tree management.
Right. Yeah. So that's what I've done. If we can, I'd like to put a couple of real quick plugs in. On May 2nd, it's a Tuesday, and in the evening from 6 to 9 p.m., we're having a Forest Service guy, Dr. Hesburgh, come in and do a presentation on the era of megafire. Several of us went and listened to this presentation last Thursday. It's very enlightening. I think people would really enjoy seeing, kind of how we got to where we are now. He has a very clear and quick presentation, and then some suggestions on what we can do, whether it's defensible space or fuels reduction. But I think most everyone would enjoy listening to this man. He's been doing research for 30 years. So that's May 2nd, Tuesday evening from 6 to 9. And we'll have a number of booths there. It's at the Panhandle Bank building. Ah. Where the Tango is.
Yeah, I think it's Columbia Bank.
Columbia Bank Building. Okay, excuse me. It's where the Tango is. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And we'll have booths there and be able to have experts there that can talk to everybody about their own fire prevention needs.
Maybe more of these resources. Checklists.
Oh, yeah. We'll have checklists there, too.
And that's and Dr. Paul Hesburgh.
Paul Hesburgh, yes.
Yeah, I've heard him speak. He's fabulous. Yeah. He specializes in our region in the Northwest and the fire histories.
Yeah, and he's doing, I'll say he's doing 100 of the, or at least 50 of these presentations this season alone. So it's really good. IFG had him last week and did a good job with it. And then I wanted to say, put a plug in for we have a fire prevention co-op up here. All of the departments in our county, the fire departments contribute. And that's the type of, that's the organization that helps us with brochures and funding for our Ember House that we just built, and lots of different ways to reach out to kids for public education at the schools.
Help me understand the co-op. Is it an outreach program? Do they do projects? What's their purpose?
All the departments band together and put a small amount of money every year into this fund. We only have a few different public events here across the year. But for instance, Sam Owen has a pancake breakfast. It's an ideal time for kids and families to learn more about fire prevention. But for them to have an Ember House and all these different props and supplies, doesn't make sense to have that for one day a week, instead, or one event a year. So instead, we have a cooperative.
You'll chip in and
we all chip in for equipment and supplies.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Sounds like it's working.
Well, we're running about out of time, but this was a wonderful information and very timely coming into a season when we can now look around and see what's melted off outside, protect our homes from the coming wildfire season, and look inside too.
Yes, I'm going to run home and get my new address numbers that I haven't done yet, and then move my brush pile a little ways.
That'll be great. Yes. We'd all appreciate that for us and for you yourself. And again, I just want to we're still willing to do property visits and get our check sheet out. And if anyone's interested in or has questions about their own property situation, they can call us 263-3502.
I highly recommend it. It's very helpful, guys.
Thanks very much for hosting this.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Well, we're going to let Mark leave with a little music from the Marshall Tucker Band, and then Julie and I will come back with a few community calendar events. So. Way to hit the high notes. Marshall Tucker Band, Fire on the Mountain.
There are sure some really good fire songs out there, Phil. Well,
I think fire,
great ones.
Fire is inspirational. I don't think this was probably the case with our guest today, but you know, the boys that grow up to be cops are often robbers, and the fire protection people are often pyromaniacs, I've heard, at least.
The crime fighter and the criminal linked. Well,
if you've enjoyed the show and you missed any of it, you can listen to the podcast sometime later today, and they're on at KRFY.org, and you can always listen to us live streaming if you're out of town at www.krfy.org or right here at 88.5, listener-supported radio for North Idaho.
That's right. Well, we've got some interesting upcoming morning shows, Phil.
We do. Tomorrow, April 5th, join morning show hosts Susie Perez and Chris Bessler. Their guests this week will be Aaron Bernal with Bonner General Health. That's at 8 a.m. right here at 88.5. Then on Thursday, tune in for the Thursday edition of the morning show with Jack Peterson and Jim Healy. They always have a lot of great guests. Not sure who it's going to be this week. Next week, I'll be in PA, where hopefully it's warm and sunny, not rainy, and Julie's going solo, I think.
That's true. Let's do hope it's warm and sunny there, Phil. Next Tuesday, we've got a very interesting show. We're going to be joined by Ed Busby and Gene Jones, and they are representatives from an event that's happening south of Chewelah, Washington in May. It's called the Gathering Between the Rivers, and they are instructors and experts in a skill we call ancestral living skills or primitive living skills. It's an interesting topic.
That should be a lot of fun.
Yes. Well, on to current events. We've got time for a couple upcoming events, and one that you might want to be sure to attend would be tomorrow on the 5th, and that is called Replant Your Refund Day. It's the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society pairing with Baxter's on Cedar. They're hosting, as I mentioned, Replant Your Refund. Baxter's will share a percentage of the day's receipts with the Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society. So get on down to Baxter's and participate and help out the Kinnickinnick Plant Society.
Celebrate mud season with a little bit of extra effort to support native plants.
It's so true. Another thing that you might want to be thinking about taking in would be the, it's another plant-related item, and it is, I'm looking for it. Well, let's move on to something on the 8th, 9th, and I'll come back to the plant one. That is the spring finale. That's up at Schweitzer. Fun family-friendly events are going to take center stage, and there will be a Pondere Rotary Duck Derby, pond skimming, etc. For more information on those, you may call 208-255-3081.
I think we have time for one more upcoming event.
All right. Well, something that you might want to catch on the 8th is going to be management and restoration of the Bull River. The Pondere chapter of Idaho Master Naturalists is inviting the public to a class on the management and restoration of the Bull River, and that's an important river. That's going to be held from 9:30 a.m. until 12:30 at the Waterlife Discovery Center right here on the Lakeshore Drive south of town. Sagal, Britta Olson will be there to explain her work in this sensitive area. And for more information there, you may email them at imn.sandpoint@gmail.org.
That's going to about wrap it up for today's show. And it was a good one. We're going to take it out with a little bit of The Doors, Light My Fire.